You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Welcome to Brookings. My name is Ron Haskins. I'm the co-director of the Center on Children and Families at Brookings, along with Richard Reeves. And I'm pleased to host this event to mark publication of a new volume on evidence-based policy in sponsorship by the American Academy of Political and Social Science. I'm here with Senator Young, a Republican from Indiana. Senator Young, thank you so much for coming, and even more for writing a chapter, a very interesting chapter for the volume, as many of you will find when you read the chapter. There's a rumor in Washington that senators don't know how to write, but you proved that wrong. I think you'll find it a fascinating chapter with a lot of stuff about Edison in there. I think it's pretty clear Edison believed in evidence.
He did.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, and you make that very clear. Let me just say one word about Senator Young's background, and then we'll get rolling. So you attended the Naval Academy, became a U.S. Marine officer in 2005. Elected to the House in 2010 and the Senate in 2016. That's 11 years from graduating from college, in effect, to becoming a U.S. Senator. That doesn't happen very often. Married with four children, so you had some time to do other things while you were getting an education and running for office. And then in your relatively brief time in Washington, this is directly pertinent to our event, you've established a reputation as a friend of evidence-based policy, one of the best in Washington. And you played a key role in legislation to pass promotion of evidence-based policy, especially Pay for Success, which maybe you'll talk about a little bit. So welcome. I'm sure our audience would like to hear you and what you have to say about evidence-based policy, so the floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much, Ron. I'm grateful to be here and appreciate the opportunity to include an article in the Annals, which we're here to celebrate. And to promote evidence-based policymaking, as opposed to what some would refer to as policy-based evidence-making, which happens a lot on Capitol Hill. So my interest in this area really was a function of finding myself on the Ways and Means Committee after one term in the House of Representatives. And there's a subcommittee, of which many of you are familiar, on Ways and Means, that focuses on many of the social challenges and social programs that are important to the American people. They serve the poor, the vulnerable, the at-risk. My first sort of threshold question before I tried to develop a familiarity with these programs was, which ones work? And how do we know that they work? And I was I fumbled around a bit, and I was dispirited to learn that the evidence base on so many of our social and our public health programs as well was not robust, was not rigorous. And it took me a while to really get a level of confidence that that was, in fact, the case. Surely our federal government, with roughly 80 different programs, had been rigorously evaluating whether or not these programs were effectively serving the least among us. But I discovered that really wasn't the case. And there are a number of reasons for that. One has to do with the fact that many are sort of more psychologically inclined to measure intentions by inputs as opposed to outcomes. I understand that. That's a superficial impulse, but nonetheless, I understand that predilection. The other is maybe more of a political function of the fact that when we have success, however you might define success, when in fact it's actually defined for a particular program, press releases are issued, members of Congress show up, maybe cut a ribbon, and celebrate the effectiveness. But when there are, I don't like the word failures, I really don't, but when there are suboptimal outcomes, when a program has proven to be fruitless or to bear less fruit than might be possible, little is said. That tends to be something that we politicians don't like to associate ourselves with. So, and program managers. Moreover, their vested interests, who have a natural inclination to keep particular programs in place without making any sorts of changes, and those can that can result in a certain stasis or lack of creativity or rigor, not just in the evaluation of programs, but in implementing any needed changes. But times are a-changing, in part because the leadership of people like Ron and the Brookings Institution and so many who are in the audience today and other scholars around the town, around town and around the world, you continue to fight the fight to make sure that we optimally serve those who need to be served. And there's a lot of innovation that's occurring. Some of it on account of the way we test different programs. In this era of big data, it's now easier to conduct a randomized controlled trial across multiple sites than it was a decade or two decades ago, because we have large data sets and more people who are sophisticated at manipulating those data sets. And the cost of conducting these trials has gone down. So that works to our advantage. The world's become more globalized, and I think increasingly the academic and policy community is interacting with one another across borders. So we're learning from the examples not just of other localities and other states, but even other countries. So the marketplace of ideas, I believe, is forcing change. I would add that the current fiscal situation, you know, we're well over $20 trillion in debt. There are a lot of reasons for that. But that leads to an imperative during this era of scarce resources to make sure that every taxpayer dollar that is spent wisely, out of sort of a sobering recognition that there are certain limitations to what we can spend. Let's make sure that we're serving more people more effectively using the existing dollars before we start expanding the ambit of dollars that are spent overall. I think that's at least where we should start with respect to our social programs. This ought to be natural for us as a country. We are a country of inventors, of innovators, of doers and dreamers, of pioneers, of titans like Thomas Edison, who tried and failed many times in his effort to commercialize a light bulb, trying hundreds of filaments. He didn't regard each of those efforts as a failure. He learned from each of those efforts and iteratively added that bit of knowledge from each of these suboptimal outcomes that informed his future efforts, and ultimately he came up with a successful model. Moreover, we have the most vibrant civil society in all of human history, I would argue. This is something Tocqueville wrote about in the 1830s. We are a country of associations, of little platoons, if you prefer Burke. And we gather together, we solve problems collectively at the local level. There's one of the things I've come to really appreciate during my time as first a member of the U.S. House of Representatives and now a U.S. Senator, it's how much good just rank and file neighbors, community groups, not-for-profits, sometimes for-profit groups are doing to address our thorniest social and public health pathologies. Now, many of these groups do not have even the sort of modest resources required to effectively evaluate their programs and why they work. Some of their success may not be replicated across geographies and different populations, but much of it, I think, can be. So one of the challenges is to scale up things that are working, not just in government, but scale up things that are working at the local level, at the state levels, and also to scale up some of our federal government programs. I've come up with one model, really, in fairness, adapted a British model to the United States with a piece of legislation that we have styled the Social Impact Partnership to Pay for Results Act. For those who are familiar with the social impact bond model, you know it's not really a bond. It's a network of contracts between service providers and different levels of government and private individuals, private investors. And the idea is to bring private capital into solving our most pressing social and public health challenges, scale up those things that we know work. One example would be the nurse family partnership. Any of you are familiar with the nurse family partnership? You take a social worker, you take a public health worker, you dispatch them into low-income areas. They visit with expectant mothers to make sure those mothers are prepared to lead a healthy lifestyle and make sure that that child is born without complication. And then the social worker will remain periodically visiting the mother and child during that child's infancy. Look, the educational outcomes are markedly improved through an implementation of the nurse family partnership with Fidelity across populations, across geographies. We know this. The evidence is so strong. The public health improvements are enormous. We save Medicaid dollars. We save special education dollars. So the idea here is to avoid the human cost of suboptimal interventions, to avoid having to put a child into a special education program, to avoid the health complications that result from not properly caring for one's infant. And oh, by the way, to avoid those expenditures as well. If we can come up with some level of specificity under this social impact partnership model of how much money might be saved for serving a given population through effective implementation of the nurse family partnership, we can invite in private capital, whether it's through institutional investors or foundations or high net worth individuals, to scale up something like the nurse family partnership. And only if results are achieved, only if we improve lives, are those investors paid back out of future government savings. Taxpayers win. The recipients win. The recipients of these services. We all win. This model can be applied to a range, a panoply of different social and public health challenges. There's many other models out there. But really, the emphasis is on rigorously evaluating what works, on making sure we're rewarding, not inputs, but instead outcomes, and learning from those suboptimal outcomes, talking about those suboptimal outcomes, and in the end, incorporating that knowledge iteratively into our next set of interventions, whether they're governmental in nature or non-governmental in nature. So I'm here because I believe in this whole notion of evidence-based policymaking, whether that's governmental policy, non-governmental, or what I've just described, some hybrid of the two. I'm grateful for you giving me the platform to lay out some of my thoughts on this topic, and I really look forward to working, Ron, with you and so many others who here who are present or watching this event today to continue to advance evidence-based policy in Congress.
Well, you certainly have used the platform well, both in the written article and in your 8 minutes or whatever you just talked.
Yeah.
Let me begin with the national, the family program that you just talked about. It is a successful program. We have a lot of evidence. But most federal programs and state programs, we don't have good evidence. And when we have evidence, in a majority of cases, or quite a bit more than a majority of cases, they do not work. So my question to you is, how can you convince your colleagues to pay attention to that evidence and to do something different, to figure out a way to use the money more wisely and to produce good results?
I can think of a couple of ways. One, I can withhold my co-sponsorship of legislation that doesn't include an evaluative component to that legislation. Set aside a modest amount of money to evaluate the effectiveness of a given program, report on the effectiveness as a sort of trigger for Congress to pull the plug on a given program after a period of years or not. If I do that over a period of time, as a member of say, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, I think that's one way that I can make a difference. Two, I can continue to communicate about the importance of rigor and evaluation and paying for success on the floor of the United States Senate and other forums like this one and beyond. So that's another thought. You know, one of the reasons I like the social impact partnership model is because my hope would be that if we can generate enough successes through this model, and I would define success here for the academics among us who like to define everything, I understand it, I would define success as an improvement upon the status quo. But if we can improve upon the status quo through the social impact partnership model or other pay-for-success models, then we have a new body of evidence that creates a moral imperative for those who might be ordinarily persuaded not to change a particular program to instead change their mind. So, look, I know you're receiving pressure, you know, colleague A, not to touch this sacred cow of a program. But we now know that a better way to address prisoner reentry, a better way to address asthma in low-income communities, a better way to get the long-term unemployed integrated back into the workforce is here or here or here. We have strong evidence. There's a moral imperative that you act. I think that can be really persuasive to my colleagues and cut through some of the pressures they might otherwise feel, because most people, my colleagues on the right and left, run for public office to do good, and they have good hearts. It just takes some really compelling evidence, which oftentimes doesn't exist, to persuade them.
Let me ask you one last question on this exact point. When I was a staffer with the Ways and Means Committee, I sat in many of these meetings where the members talked, and I recall in 14 years a couple of times when somebody actually said something about a study.
Yeah.
So now, if you start talking about studies and what pay for success are the things that have shown, and you're trying to persuade your colleagues, if you look at the research, if you look at the studies, here's what they show. Here's how we ought to spend the money. Is that effective? Do they actually listen to you? Will they even change their vote based on what the research shows?
It depends. And in my conversations with colleagues, we all have, to varying degrees, a confirmation bias. You know, increasingly, I think scholarship is improving on behavioral science. And so we like studies that confirm our existing biases. There are MSNBC viewers here. There are Fox News viewers here. There's a certain amount of confirmation bias even in the media that people choose. It's painful to have to change your mind, especially as you grow older and learn that you've spent many years, many painstaking hours working on something that really didn't help people, may have even injured them, right? So I think one way to get through this is to make sure that there are these joint relationships. So I really like how Brookings has partnered with AEI on some different studies, and consensus views have been arrived at. I found quite instructive the work that you did working with Robert Doerr and some others on the lack of economic mobility in this country and the extent to which our existing social programs have indeed improved the lives of our citizens. That was a consensus view, but the nuance there is there's a huge opportunity cost because they're not well targeted, right? So that, again, a consensus view. So I think it's important that people of different minds, academics, policy experts, come up with consensus views, find where there are areas of agreement. It gives great credibility, I think, to findings, especially in an institution like the United States Senate, where it takes 60 votes to get things passed. The other thing we need to do is make sure that our evaluations are actually utilized. There are a lot of studies out there that are forgotten about, so we have to come up with a way to maybe cut off the funding if the evaluation determines that a particular program is not effective. We need to get in the habit, and again, I request that colleagues sunset their legislation oftentimes before it receives my co-sponsorship. I sunset my own legislation, including the social impact partnership legislation, because I want to make sure that that model works, and that creates sort of a moment at which it's a forcing action for Congress to act. And so those are some of my thoughts, and I would welcome others to share with me, you know, if not today, then in the future, other ideas about how we might get more of my colleagues who are well-intentioned, thoughtful people, with few exceptions, to focus on the evidence, just as the private sector so frequently does. They test, they beta test, then they go big. We here in Washington go big early way too often, and I think that's a mistake.
Yeah. I am getting signals from your staff.
Yeah.
Implicitly threatening me that if you know that if you don't leave within 30 seconds, you're never coming to Brookings again. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Here.
Thanks, Ron.
Yeah. I'll see you soon. Yeah. All right. I'm sorry, audience. I didn't realize it was going to end this quickly. I was going to hope to have at least one question from the audience. As you could see, the senator was late. He was on a very tight schedule, so things started off squeezed, which often happens. Now we have a film. You can't squeeze the film because it's already filmed, and we're going to show it up here on the screen. It stars Senator Carper and Andrea Kane sitting right there in the fourth row, and I ask them questions, and that's all I do. So when that's over, I'll come back up here, and we'll continue the event. Thank you. So, Senator, thank you as well as your staff for your enthusiastic participation in this volume. The chapter you, Andrea, and Isabel Sawhill wrote on pregnancy prevention was a terrific contribution to the volume. Andrea, from the influential Power to Decide organization, formerly the campaign to prevent unplanned pregnancy, is also with us today and will participate in the discussion. I'm going to give you the shortest introduction ever given to a U.S. senator.
Why?
Because of our limitation of time.
Okay.
Yeah. So you served in the U.S. military for 23 years, including three tours in Vietnam as a naval flight officer. You were elected three times to serve as Delaware State Treasurer, five times to serve in the House of Representatives, twice as governor, and you're now in your third term
Delaware
senator. Well, I determined that if I added up all the years, that you must have been in public service since shortly after the administration of George Washington. Approximately correct?
From the third grade.
Yeah. All right, Senator, let's begin with this. As someone who has spent many years in public service, how have you relied on data and evidence to guide your decision making?
One of my core values has been find out what works and do more of that. That's it. Find out what works and do more of that.
How do you find out what works?
And if you don't have the data, if you don't have the information, if you don't find out what works and document that, then how do we know? And what I do is just that. I work with the General Accountability Office. I work with Inspector Generals. I work with OMB, our Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. We rely on the data. And when I was governor, I got to be chairman of the National Governance Association, and after that, to lead the NGA's Center for Best Practices. And we always were comparing, stealing ideas from one another, but also looking for, to find out what works in a wide range of areas.
Did you notice an increase in the number of high-quality studies that actually tested ideas for solving social problems?
No, here lately, I've not noticed so much focus on actually using good data and good information. There's a lot of fake news and fake numbers as well. Yeah. But if we're going to actually make progress, we got to find the data, drill down on it, and make sure we know what works.
Okay, in your many years of experience in the House and Senate, have you seen an increase, not just yourself, but in your colleagues in the House and the Senate, in their use of data, and especially in evidence-based policy?
It's a mixed bag. In some cases, you have great example. Patty Murray, wonderful senator, for Democrat from Washington, and the Speaker of the House, and of them working together in a way that provides a good example for the rest of us. In other cases, we have people just saying whatever they think or whatever they want people to think. So it's a mixed bag.
So what opportunities do you see to stimulate greater use of evidence? One of the purposes of the evidence-based movement is to encourage people, especially elected officials, to look for better data, to finance better data. Do you see that that's a realistic possibility? Would you support that? Do you think your colleagues would?
We had a hearing just this morning in the Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs with really focus on governmental affairs. We had in one of the top administration officials from OMB, a very bright woman named Margaret Weikert. And she was presenting a government overhaul that the administration was laying at our feet to consider, as not just to do in the next month or even the next year, but something to consider over the next several years. And one of the things that we talked about is the need to not just say, well, who thinks this might work, but to actually understand what's working in the states.
Yeah.
And one of the great examples, I like to say that states are laboratories of democracy. If we're going to try something big, why don't we, rather than just starting government-wide at the federal level, why don't we find out what's worked, whether it's in Delaware or Minnesota or Wyoming or some other state?
Yeah. When I first met you, we were working on welfare reform.
Yes, we were.
Yeah, and you may remember, let's not tell when that was, but
it was recently.
Recently. You may remember that 41 states were doing exactly the kind of demonstrations you're talking about here and doing high-quality, they're called random assignment studies, to figure out what works in welfare reform and how they could encourage mothers on welfare to work. So that has, it's kind of an old story, but then it died down, and we haven't had nearly as much of it lately. So if the government could encourage it more, I think we'd be in very good shape, so I'm glad.
We recently debated in the Senate agriculture policy. Every 5 years or so, we do a big farm bill.
Yeah.
And a big piece of the farm bill, as you know, is nutrition.
Yeah.
And includes the SNAP program, which used to be food stamps. But we focused a lot in the welfare reform, and we wanted welfare to pay more than work. We wanted people to be better off when they worked. And one of the nice things, when we drilled down on the in the Senate on the farm bill on nutrition and the SNAP program, we actually looked at what was working for people to work. We don't want to take away. We want to provide disincentives for people to work. But that was actually very encouraging,
yeah.
And it's something that's happened in real time this year.
Unfortunately, it often happens that they don't work well, so then you've got to figure out new ways to do it so you can actually make them work, which we hope is that. Role of the Congress. So, Andrea, let me bring you into this. What can we learn from the example of teen pregnancy and, more generally, women of all ages, pregnancy reduction, from the chapter that you wrote with a senator?
Well, I think one of the things we've learned is exactly what Senator Carper just talked about, which is that states are following the evidence to reduce unplanned pregnancy and improve outcomes for children and families. There is very encouraging evidence coming out of a number of states, Colorado being the first, then also St. Louis, the St. Louis area, and Iowa, about when you reduce barriers to contraception for women and make sure that there's a level playing field so they can pick the most effective contraception based on the evidence, we see really positive outcomes. And governors and other policymakers have seized on that evidence across party lines. We've seen this kind of thing happening now in red states, blue states, purple states, and it's spreading. So I think there is hope that when there is good evidence out there, people do try to follow it. It gets shared through different dissemination channels. Just one example, the now governor of Virginia read about the research from Colorado that showed that their teen birth rate had gone down by half after they implemented a new program to increase access to contraception, and said, we should do that in Virginia. He's now governor, and after a couple of attempts, that's now just passed. So we do see these kinds of things spreading, which I think is very encouraging. Mm.
You might just mention great things are going on in Delaware as well.
Absolutely.
Our immediate past governor, Jack Markell, wonderful guy, who was also chairman of the National Governors Association. But we've had a high teen pregnancy rate in Delaware for too long. We focused on when I was governor. We focused on how do we strengthen the basic building block of our society, families. And it really started and put together a multi-departmental task force for 7 years, or 8 years actually, as governor, that focused on how do we strengthen families. And it started with reducing the incidence of unplanned, unwanted pregnancies. We brought in a whole bunch of kids from high schools all over the state, two from every public high school, male, female, and from all walks of life to say, this is what we think would work to reduce the incidence of teen pregnancy. A wonderful woman named Marion Wright Edelman once said these, and I'll paraphrase what she said. She said, when a 16-year-old girl becomes pregnant, drops out of school, does not marry the father of her child, and does not go back into school, there's an 80% likelihood that they'll live in poverty.
Yep.
That same 16-year-old girl does not get pregnant, does not drop out of school, waits till 21 to have a child, marries the father of her child, there's an 8% likelihood that they will live in poverty. 80% on the one hand, 8% on the other hand. That I've never forgotten that number. Whenever I speak in high schools to assemblies, I ask the kids, high school kids, I say, how many of you want to live in poverty? And you know, there's usually a jokester somewhere that will always raise their hand and say, oh, I like to live in poverty. Nobody, in all the times, dozens of times I've done this, no one has ever raised a hand one time. Nobody wants to live in poverty. And one of the great predictors of families are going to live in poverty is what I just explained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. And the data are very clear on that.
A part of this story that you go into, and it's very interesting and well put in your article, is about LARCs, long-acting reversible contraception. I think we ought to tell just a little bit of that story because it's so fascinating and it has tremendous potential.
Absolutely. So LARCs, long-acting reversible contraceptives.
Not a new idea.
It's not a new idea, although it's now spreading because we have more data and evidence.
It was a good idea a long time ago that got a very bad development in it, and
right.
We finally fixed it, but I think we still have lived with the legacy of that,
yes,
of that tragedy.
Absolutely. So for those who may not know, LARC include intrauterine devices, or IUDs, or implants that actually go in the arm, and they are highly effective. All the scientific research has shown that they're about 20 times more effective than other methods of birth control.
What is it, like 99% effective?
Exactly, about 99%
compared
effective.
Compared to what?
Depending on other methods of contraception, 60, 80, 85%. Why they're so effective is that once they are in place, a woman doesn't have to do anything, so they're sort of foolproof.
You don't have to remember to take a pill. You don't have to hope that somebody's going to have a condom
exactly.
that works.
That's exactly
none of that
right.
stuff.
That's exactly right. They're not right for everybody, but what we want to do and what these states and others are doing now is making sure people know how effective they are, how safe they are, how easy to use they are, so that women who want to use them can. And what we've seen in places like Delaware is that when you reduce barriers and make them available to everybody, many women are choosing them. So again, it's having the science and the evidence drive policy and practice. We still have a long way to go. There's still a lot of barriers. And I think one of the things that's really challenging right now is while we have this forward momentum in places like Delaware and Colorado and other places, there's also some real threats to those policies.
There are few areas in social policy where we're making as much progress as we are against teen pregnancy prevention. How did you first get interested? I know you've been involved for a long time.
When I ran for governor, I was a congressman, ran for governor. Mike Castle was our governor. He was running for Congress. We were trading places like the movie Trading Places. He won. He became congressman. I won. I became governor. But before we were sworn into our new offices, we were at a dinner together in Wilmington, and the big dinner, a lot of people there. And the fellow who was the MC introduced both of us to speak, and he raised this question. He said, "If in your new job, Congressman, Governor, Congressman, soon to be Congressman Castle, soon to be Governor Carper, if you could have a magic wand, to start on your new responsibilities, what would you choose? And I said, here's what I'd like to walk into my office first day as governor, open the drawer, and pull out a magic wand that would allow me to make sure that every child in my state had at least one loving, caring, nurturing parent, mm-hmm. at least one, hopefully two. And two months later, I'm inaugurated governor. I walked into my new office. I opened the drawer. There's no magic wand. But about a month later, one of the cabinet secretaries, was a holdover from the Castle administration, came in and said, we ought to have a statewide focus, multi-year effort on strengthening families. I remember being in prison about a month or two later after that, where we had a lot of 50 inmates in a room with me and the nation's drug czar. And the nation's drug czar was there, Clinton drug czar, was there to see what we're doing to reduce the incidence of recidivism. And we had like 50 mostly young inmates. And I remember asking these inmates to say, tell the drug czar and me, how did you get here? What happened in your life to get here? Well, they were mostly 18, 19, 20, 25. And one after the other started with this. I was born when my mom was young. I never knew my dad. I started kindergarten behind. I couldn't read or write. Many other kids in my class mm-hmm. could. I mean, and for me, I said, bingo. This idea of a family services cabinet council where we focus on starting on teen pregnancy, we should do that. And we should do it for 8 years. And we did. It was the single best thing we did.
Senator, and what's dramatic is that since then, the teen birth rates in Delaware and around the country have gone down by well over 50%.
And so it really is remarkable. The incidence of abortion.
Which yes.
is one of the things we don't focus on. One of the best ways to reduce the demand for abortions is to do a much better job on contraceptives. And the top of the line on contraceptives is IUDs and LARCs.
So, Senator, thank you so much, not just for this interview, but for the great article that you wrote with Andrea and with Bell Sawhill of Brookings. And, of course, as you know, we're going to show it at tomorrow's event where we're going to release the journal, and we'll have thousands of people crowding the Brookings Auditorium to
thousands.
Release
are they thinking of moving it to RFK or Matt Stadium?
RFK is too old.
Probably so.
I think the opening sentence in your article for the chapter shows what I believe most people who are interested in evidence-based policy would want policymakers to say. And here's exactly what you say. A growing number of policymakers and program leaders at the federal, state, and community level are committed to using unbiased evidence to guide them in solving tough social problems. I know that you've done that throughout your career, and we can only hope that more policymakers will do the same thing.
From your lips to God's ears.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Because we're not focusing our event on this wonderful journal, some of you, 50 of you have copies of this. I'm sorry we didn't have enough for everybody. But it's available online. There are instructions on how to get it. It's open to everybody, and you can print out whatever you want to. I've noticed in the past that people don't always want to print everything in a journal. You might want one or two or five articles. So I want to take just a few minutes to give you a little bit of information about the contents of this volume to promote your understanding of the evidence-based movement. After all, that is our major purpose. When Tom Kecskemethy is sitting right here, who is the executive director of the American Academy of Political and Social Science, our sponsor, offered me the opportunity to edit a volume on evidence-based policy, I immediately accepted. My thought from the very beginning was to get the leading experts in the field to write about the biggest issues, thereby creating a volume that would provide a non-technical overview of the field with a substance divided into short, snappy chapters. Perhaps our readers will agree that the authors have achieved this most important goal. There are 17 chapters in the volume. I cannot do more than hint at the scope and precision and competence with which they were written. The introduction, written by me at excessive length, aims to give readers an overview of the entire volume and hence the major parts of the evidence-based movement in one single place. John Barron of the Arnold Foundation provides a fascinating history of the development of evidence-based research and policy, going back to the amazing work of Richard Dole, a British epidemiologist, who declared in the 1930s that medical schools were a joke. because few, if any, of the treatments on offer had been systematically tested, so it was evidence-based from the beginning. Barron proceeds to bring the story all the way up to the influential research on welfare and employment policy in the 1980s and 1990s that had a major impact on policy. As Larry Orr, who's out there somewhere, of Johns Hopkins reminds us, randomized control trials are the foundation of evidence-based policy. They are the major tool we use to identify social programs that actually produce impacts. So far, we have found, perhaps to our surprise, that few programs are successful. But it does not require great optimism to think that we're moving in the right direction and that we are constantly developing more successful programs. Stay tuned. We're moving in the right direction. Showing the range of both the volume and the field, we include a chapter by Patrick Lester on the Pew and MacArthur Results First program, which appears to have achieved what was previously thought to have been impossible, getting states to terminate or modify spending on programs that are unsuccessful and using the money to improve the programs or spend on programs with stronger evidence of success. In a chapter on the spectacular Poverty Action Lab at MIT, which has grown to more than 150 researchers who have conducted more than 900 RCTs in 90 countries that have impacted over 300 million people. Strong evidence of success as well. The chapter on behavioral economics, written by two of its most notable practitioners, Bill Congdon and Maya Shankar, shows many examples of how the theory and practice of behavioral economics can improve government policy and save money. The chapter by George Overhauser, who will be up here talking in a few minutes, of Third Sector Capital Partners, will surprise those who are familiar with his role in developing the Pay for Success program. He presents a substantially revised version of the original design, which there's good reason to believe will make it more practical for organizations to adopt and operate. We have five chapters on the contribution of institutions on the evidence-based movement, the Office of Management and Budget by Kathy Stack, who's also in the audience, the Institute of Education and Sciences by Russ Whitehurst, who will be on the panel, and the role of nonprofit organizations in designing and implementing evidence-based policy by Jim Sullivan, and a chapter on other federal agencies by Becca Maynard. Without the work of these institutions, evidence-based policy would be little more than a concept. With them, we get action, especially implementation and development. I wanted to have two chapters on the significance of the evidence-based movement, one more upbeat about its achievements and one more skeptical. As it turned out, the chapters are two of the most thoughtful in the volume, and both are a provocative blend of skepticism and optimism. One of the chapters by Ginger Knox, Carolyn Hill, and Gordon Berlin, three of the most capable practitioners of both program evaluation and drawing conclusions from programmatic research. They address the Achilles heel of the evidence-based movement, namely program replication. Perhaps none of you will be surprised to discover that if it's difficult and relatively rare to find a program that actually produces impacts, how much more difficult must it be to find a program that produces positive impacts in many settings and with many groups of children or adults? Yet Knox, Hill, and Berlin have what looks to me like a possible solution to the replication conundrum. The chapter is followed by a compelling chapter on three orders of challenges researchers face in producing evidence that could lead to realistic policy solutions by Adam Gameron, who will be on our panel in a minute, the president of the Grant Foundation. As much as any chapter in the volume, this one gives readers a concrete view of the challenges facing researchers who want their research to help solve social problems. Finally, we have a terrific chapter on using administrative data in research, an issue recently highlighted by the Ryan Murray Evidence-Based Policymaking Commission. And then, of course, we have two chapters written by U.S. senators, kind of a rare thing to see. These chapters provide convincing evidence that there are influential policymakers who not only know about evidence-based policy, but who practice it. There you have it. With abject apologies to the authors for my poor ability to capture the glories of each of these chapters, I think Tom Kekskamenthy is trying to think up ways to punish me for such a pale summary of the wonderful chapters in this volume. I hope he fails. I now have the privilege of welcoming Megan McArdle, a dazzling new editorial writer for the Washington Post, Megan will moderate our panel discussion. Before turning things over to her, I want to emphasize to people who might notice that no one from the Trump administration is on the panel. We've been talking with officials from the Trump administration for 4 weeks about sending a representative. We found out Monday that they were not able to work out the details. I invite Megan and our panel to come to the stage. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming and staying to hear our great panel. We have Adam Gameron, who just told me how to pronounce his last name, who is the president of the William T. Grant Foundation, George Overholtzer, who is president and founder of Third Sector Capital Partners, and Grover J. Russ Whitehurst, who is a senior fellow in economic studies and at the Center on Children and Families, Brookings, and then there's me. So everyone has their, they're gonna do brief presentations on their papers, and then we're gonna have a little chat, and hopefully we'll have at least a few minutes for questions from the audience at the end. So I'm just gonna suggest that we go this way in order. So Mr. Whitehurst.
Well, welcome everybody, and thanks Ron for inviting me to be part of this and to contribute to the volume. I was torn between talking about the paper I wrote for the volume, which is about the agency in the federal government of which I was the founding director of the Institute of Education Sciences, torn between that and talking about the evidence in the Trump administration. I'm going to do probably a feeble job of getting those two things together in one way, one way or another. Broadly, I think there's an arc of human history that bends towards increasing rationality and use of evidence. And that can be reflected in some periods of progress and some periods of retreat, but I think we move forward. And the reason for that, I think, is not so much an inherent or innate progressive movement of history, but rather the use of evidence increasingly allows a more receptive audience for evidence. So I was reading in the Post or the Times, I don't remember which, I'm sorry for that, a piece yesterday about loss aversion.
If it was good, I'm sure it was in the Post.
I'm sure it was. Loss aversion is a psychological phenomenon, behavioral economics phenomenon, identified about 30 years ago. And basically, winning a dollar is not nearly as emotion generating as losing a dollar. So it's more painful to lose than to win. And so as we know that, and as people are struggling to create policy, and that policy involves taking something away from someone and giving them something else, it's almost impossible not to use that knowledge as a way of rolling out the policy for political and other reasons to make it more successful. So my argument is the more we know, the more likely we are to use evidence, because the evidence itself has embedded in it mechanisms for progress. With respect to the Institute of Education Sciences, I think it is, I believe the reason I was invited to write about it for the volume is that it is a marked indicator of the ability of the federal government to change its way of behaving and to be more active in producing evidence. So U.S. Department of Education and its predecessor in health, education, and welfare had research offices for a very long time. They were abysmal failures. Up through 2001, the Department of Education had conducted only two randomized trials in its history with respect to the effectiveness of the programs it was delivering. There was little appetite for evidence and little supply of evidence. My first couple of years in office, I'd go up to Congress and they would say, well, what are you doing and what do we know? And I would dance around and talk about the promise of the future, but there really was very little to put on the table. Last time I looked, which was to do this volume, the What Works Clearinghouse, which is a focused effort by the Institute of Education Sciences within the U.S. Department of Education to identify what works and what the size of those effects are and how much they cost, had conducted over 10,000 evidence reviews, had identified, from memory, 340 different studies that were well-conducted, randomized trials or close approximations, and found evidence of what worked and what didn't. So if I had the job now that I had back in 2001, 2002, I wouldn't have to dance around it. I could talk about a list of things that have been shown to work, a larger list of things that have been shown not to work, and encourage people to use that evidence going forward. The question is, what is the present state of evidence in the Trump administration? What do we need to worry about? What do we need to do going forward? I think it's very important in that regard to distinguish between the production side, the supply side of the equation, and the utilization or demand side of the equation. The production side, I'm referring to the people who do the studies, who collect the statistics, who make the reports. On the demand side of the equation, I'm talking about people in the White House who could use that evidence, people in Congress who could use the evidence, practitioners in the field. I believe at least at present, the production enterprise is not at risk. Congress continues to fund the offices that do research evaluation and publish statistics. Those offices are doing their work. They're publishing the reports. I see no evidence, at least in the part of that that world I'm familiar with, of any inappropriate political influence in the process. So as long as Congress continues to fund that activity, the offices will continue to do their work. On the demand side of the equation, as we've heard in some of the comments in the earlier material today, I think there's a tremendous amount of hunger at the state level and sometimes at the local level for evidence that's actually relevant to what those entities are trying to do and that helps them do it more effectively. So I think that the natural supply line, the place where the audience is greatest, and I don't see it diminishing, for the federal knowledge production effort is at the state and local level. And again, I see that as healthy. I don't see much demand in the executive branch for evidence. In previous administrations, George W. Bush administration, in which I served, and in the Obama administration, which I followed carefully, OMB was very powerful in advancing the evidence movement. There were key staff, career staff there, as well as politicals interested in this activity that moved the ball forward. I don't see that happening now. I don't see the people there who are doing this. Maybe I'm wrong. I hope so. I think there's less interest at the executive branch level, the cabinet level, in using evidence than there used to be, and that's not good. On the other hand, administrations come and go. And it's very important, I think, just to keep the train moving forward. And I think there will be greater appeals in the future, a greater audience appeal for what the evidence movement within federal government is doing. I think Congress has a critical role to play going forward, and that's why I was very encouraged by the two interviews you did this morning. Not only must they continue to fund the activity, but they must pay careful attention to the conditions in which that activity can be carried out well. And that certainly includes protecting the entities in the executive branch that collect, evaluate, produce statistics, protecting them from undue influence. The Institute of Education Sciences has a model piece of founding legislation in doing that. It operates independent of the U.S. Department of Education in its publications and priority setting, and I think it's very important for Congress to extend that kind of independence to other, particularly evaluation shops in federal government, that are under intense political pressure when they show something, when they find that something doesn't work, to which strong political commitments have been made by the administration. And so they need to be protected from the natural tendency of cabinet secretaries and other people to be very disappointed with an office that's off message. It's also, I think, important, and maybe pay for success as part of this, to have contingencies in place so that there are ways to reward those who use evidence. In business, there's a very clear bottom line. And people's salaries are often connected with how much, how well they conduct an activity whose success can be measured by that bottom line. We often can't agree in the social and behavioral and education areas what the bottom line is. There are many. The effects we get are effects on average. You know, how well does Head Start work on average all across the country? That can't be fed down to rewards for particular program operators. I think Congress has a role to play in making it to the benefit of those who are implementing the programs and those who are carrying it out when the program actually succeeds. So again, I think we move in the right direction, sometimes slowly, sometimes we step backwards, but we're moving appropriately. The progress sometimes can be amazingly fast, and then it can slow down for a while. So I'm optimistic. I hope you are. I expect that you're interested in this topic. That's why you're here, and we can share that optimism. Thank you.
Thank you. Great to follow you, Russ. I think we share some thoughts in common, particularly by the Institute of Education Sciences, and perhaps some different shading. In my remarks, I'll make three points in response to the prompt, which is, what's the status of the evidence movement in the Trump administration? So I'll make three points. The first point is bad. The status is bad. The second point is, nonetheless, there are some perhaps unexpected and surprising points of light. And the third is, it's more complicated than you think. So obviously, facts are under assault in this administration. We don't have to look any farther than the world being transfixed by the sight of a president ignoring a fact-based analysis of the intelligence community and declaring that a foreign dictator gave a really convincing denial of that evidence to be concerned about the status of the evidence movement in the Trump administration. In his first 400 days in office, President Trump uttered 2,400 falsehoods. That's an average of 6 lies per day in Twitter, in speeches, and in press interactions. And yet the counsel to the president says, those aren't lies, they're just alternative facts. Nothing could be more challenging to the notion that policy should be based on evidence than an idea that if you don't like the facts, you just make up another set of facts. Evidence is imperiled across this administration. A few minutes ago, we saw a video about the powerful evidence on efforts to reduce teen pregnancy. And yet that funding program has been killed by Health and Human Services under this administration. I think that what you say, Ross, is true to some extent. Production of evidence continues, but it is imperiled in many parts. Just last week, Health and Human Services announced a plan to delete 20 years of medical guidelines known as the National Guideline Clearinghouse of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. Also last week, the administration promoted adding work requirements to government-funded health care. That's a way of cutting benefits by declaring that the war on poverty has been won. That's like holding it up, as one commentator said, I didn't make this up, that's like holding an umbrella and saying, I'm not getting wet, even though it's raining. Again, you know, operating in the face of the evidence. Earlier, the Environmental Protection Agency ruled that its employees, its scientists, may not cite scientific research unless the data are public. That's a phony way of promoting transparency, a way to ignore scientific evidence. Similarly, staff at the Center for Disease Control were told not to use the phrases evidence-based or science-based in preparing their budget request for this year. Going back to the first days of this administration, the current administration, the Office of Management and Budget removed its language on statistical policy and standards from its website, and a housing bill that was proposed, fortunately not passed, contained the following language, quote, no federal funds may be used to design, build, maintain, utilize, or provide access to a federal database of geospatial information on community racial disparities or disparities in access to affordable housing. So these are ways in which not just the utilization, but the production of evidence is at risk. And it will require people working inside and outside government to keep that going. We're not assured of its continuity. Now, with that said, it's important to recognize sparks of light in dark times. Notably, these examples are cases of carryover across administrations from the George W. Bush administration to the Obama administration and continuing on today. I'm sure there are more, but I'll give three very quick examples. The president's fiscal year 19 budget proposal, which was not taken seriously, dismissed out of hand. And so you probably missed the important chapter 6, which is building and using evidence to improve government government effectiveness. This is a very strong chapter. It carries over and even elaborates insights developed in budget proposals in the Obama administration. It trumpeted the recommendations of the Commission on Evidence-Based Policymaking, which Ron Haskins co-chaired. It offered concrete strategies to strengthen the production and use of evidence for smarter policy decisions, and some of these proposals may actually happen, and that is President Trump's budget proposal. One key recommendation was to strengthen interagency coordination, and my second example is an interagency coordinating group on using evidence in government. This is an active group of staff involved in the research side of government who are continually grappling with the challenges of producing credible evidence and then getting it utilized by the policy divisions within their agencies. So that is an ongoing effort. And my third example, some federal agencies at least are promoting the production of high-quality evidence for decision-making. The one I know the best is the U.S. Department of Education. Both the political and the professional appointments are strong in this department, particularly the Institute of Education Sciences, the research arm of the U.S. Department of Education, which Russ founded, and is now led by one of your former appointees, and I think inspires confidence that in this agency, at least, the production of credible evidence will continue. So even in the worst of times, there is some carry-through. Will it be enough? Only with continued vigilance and efforts, I think. Third point, it's complicated. In my article in the Annals volume, I explained that there are three challenges to evidence-based policymaking. The first is producing credible evidence. We've made a lot of progress. I identify some challenges, replication is one of them, but we've made a lot of progress in this area. But the second challenge is getting evidence used, and that is the bottleneck today. Russ spoke about the supply side and the demand side. It's the demand side that continues to be problematic. We need a science of evidence use, something that the William T. Grant Foundation, which I lead, has been strongly promoting through our grant making. We need an infrastructure for evidence use, such as appeared in that OMB budget proposal. And we need partnerships inside and outside government between those who produce evidence and those who use evidence. Now, even if we could produce credible evidence and it gets used by decision makers, we still have a third challenge, and that is that social problems have deep structural roots. And so when we identify, for example, teen pregnancy programs that work, so we cut the rate of teen pregnancy in half, we still have inequality and economic insecurity in our society. We still have multiple problems. It's not attacking one problem at a time. So programs that respond to problems, even if they are affected and if they're implemented widely, do not get at the structural foundations of the deep-seated problems of inequality and economic insecurity in our society. And in my chapter, which I encourage you to read, I lay this out in more detail. For the evidence movement to get back on track and truly make progress, we need attention to all three of these challenges.
And hey. Final, last but not least.
Amen, brother. So I'm going to bring more of a practitioner's point of view. I came to this world actually from a business career. I was on the founding team of Capital One, and which was right in Virginia, actually across the river, many years ago. And our whole approach was to embrace evidence and to conduct randomized controlled trials. We did thousands and thousands and thousands of very, very high quality randomized controlled trials, and used that to drive the innovation process for our credit card company, which started as a little credit card company. We began, kind of inherited the credit card division, we had about 250 people. And 7 years later, we had 20,000 people and had been the number one growth company in the New York Stock Exchange during a three-year period, all because of our embrace of evidence. In a world where the competitive backdrop was a kind of a one-size-fits-all set of products that had not been based on evidence. And what an experience it was to build a highly decentralized culture of testing and to watch that in action. And one of the first things that we learned was the wisdom at the top was completely debunked by the evidence that pervaded the rest of the system. We no longer tried to drive innovation from the top. We instead learned to trust what was bubbling up from the bottom. The other thing that we learned was it prompted us to make posters. We put up posters all around the company of pictures of melting ice cream cones. And it said, it melts like ice cream. Now, why did we do this? We did this because we found that even when we had the perfect replication of a breakthrough innovation that had been tested and shown to be highly successful, it would not continue to work over time. And that's because in the world of human beings, it's not like physics. In physics, you learn that hydrogen and oxygen make water and it stays true. But for social programs, even if they're social programs having to do with credit cards, they stop working and they melt away over time. So when I eventually left Capital One, I moved to the nonprofit sector and have been working in the nonprofit sector for the last 15 years. Third Sector Capital Partners is a nonprofit, and our mission is to accelerate Americans' transition to a performance-driven social sector. And in many ways, our strategy is to echo the work that I had seen work so well in Capital One. And that is to build feedback loops within the procurement offices of social services around the country. So we currently have 50 people on staff. We're growing rapidly. And we're using predominantly a pay-for-success type of a model. And the idea is to, in dozens and dozens of different contracting operations, to change the way contracting happens such that providers are no longer asked to follow the recipes that were handed to them by government, but instead are being rewarded for changing the recipes, but only if those recipes bring about better results for their communities. Now, there's a subtle difference between this approach and much of the evidence-based movement overall that I think is worth spending a moment on. In general, the way that I saw government as I first showed up using evidence was what you might call a scale what works idea or a codification and scale type of an idea. Let's find something that works, and if it works, great, we'll write it into law, and then we'll say anyone who follows that recipe will get funding, which is a very exciting thing that you can do if you have a recipe that truly works and that endures over time. Unfortunately, though, these recipes melt like ice cream. And so that approach, the generalizability of RCT findings, if you will, the generalizability of these insights often doesn't work. Just because it works at one place and or in one setting doesn't mean it will continue to work over time and it will work everywhere. You know, I often make the joke, if we did music the same way we do government funding, we would all be listening to Meatloaf on an 8-track recording machine. Because 30 years ago, someone would have said, wow, that's great music, that's a great breakthrough in recording. There ought to be a law, and it would be written into law. And from that point forward, anyone who did music would have to comply to the recipe. So the second branch, which is pay for success, says, let's complement that codification approach, which does work sometimes. For instance, Upstream, which is the LARC program, I think that is an incredibly great application of the codification and scale approach. But the other branch, which is pay for success, says, let's decentralize and put, in a sense, the metaphor is, our firm, we're taking this body politic, which is very numb, and we're microsurgeons that are adding little nerve endings all over the place so that the outcomes associated with contracts are sensitive to whether or not those contracts give rise to better results for communities. And that's more of a bottom-up approach. It's not about codifying what works. It's more about rewarding innovation. And we think in the process, actually prompting more innovation to happen as people invest in trying out innovations, which in the past were not being rewarded, but which will be rewarded going forward. Final thing I'll say is in the chapter in the book, we focus on a progress we've made in our own model as practitioners. When we first started, it was exceedingly difficult to find government spending streams that were permitted to make contingent payments. It was written, here's $100 million, it's for this purpose, but it can only be used for reimbursement. And yet pay for success, the whole concept is to make payments contingent. It is also, it must be used within the year, whereas for pay success, we were saying, well, let's look further out and have multi-year type of arrangements and look at the longer term outcomes. And so we were so thwarted by that that we had to raise private money instead. And that really, the fundraising was the hard part. We would spend years, literally years, putting together one contract for one provider. That's changed a lot. In recent, our most recent project, for instance, involves $1 billion in the state of Washington, where we are working on contracts that affect 30 providers at a time, and that don't require us to raise external funding. And without going into the details, it has to do more than anything with changes in the permissible use rules. Various spending streams that have made it so that instead of having to raise new money, we can take existing money and do contingent contracting. And that is something that quietly, at the federal level and at the state level, laws are being changed to, and often just regulations are being changed, to make this a permissible use of existing spending streams. And, you know, $1 billion, we now have two. We just got going on $1 billion mandate, and we have another one that's getting lined up. So this is really starting to take root, and I'm very excited about it. So I better stop there.
Okay. Well, the name of this event to me is like it's a little bit funny when I think about it, right? Like evidence-based policy. I mean, what's the alternative? Evidence-free policymaking. But in fact, we seem to do a lot of that, right? And so I want to actually just start by talking a bit about the politics of this, because when I look out as a political columnist, when I look out at what are the big things the parties are talking about right now? Well, on the Republican side, you're talking about trade restriction, which is, there's a huge amount of evidence that this doesn't work. They've got one guy who is really a complete outlier among economists who is driving a ton of this. And you've got immigration restriction. I think that's more arguable. The evidence on what the effects of immigration is not what Trump says it is. On the other hand, we're only measuring one very small effect on wages. We're not really measuring cultural effects, proximity effects, et cetera, right? On the other side, what is trending on the left, right? Universal basic income had some interesting evidence for it in Kenya. That evidence just blew up, and it now seems like the universal basic income didn't do anything. It increased wealth, but did not produce any improvement in any other outcomes, and seems to have made their neighbors so much worse off that, in fact, the net effect of this policy is negative. I've heard nothing about that from the left. Right? I'm still hearing about the Kenya study. I'm not hearing about what happened on the early childhood education, right? This is all over every Democrat who wants to talk, oh, we're going to do early childhood education. And with all due respect to James Heckman, who is a very, very smart man, most of the evidence for this is based on 4 studies that were done now 30, 40 years ago, had tiny numbers of people in them, and seem to have had some deep methodological flaws that Heckman says he's correcting for. So, what's, I actually will ask Mr. What is the total population of students in those studies that, that we're talking about? It's hundreds, right? It's low hundreds.
Well, 65 for Heckman's favorite study, and 120 for the Abercedarian.
Right. Study. So we're talking about something that worked with 200 people, and I believe one of them was in the segregated South, which is a very different environment. I mean, you're talking about people who didn't have plumbing and running water. I mean, just extremely different situations for these things. And this is basically all of the evidence, because the evidence for the programs that we're trying to do doesn't really seem. And every day, you know, I have these discussions with Democratic policy experts, and I say, they say, you don't know about the new studies. You're completely wrong. And then I look at the studies and I say, you're actually convincing me that you aren't very good at reading studies, not that this is. And so I guess the question I have here, but then there is a contrast, mass incarceration, where there is at least a movement to do serious stuff with serious evidence led by NYU now. But it seems to me that in general, when I look at these questions, that evidence-based policymaking doesn't work where you have deep ideological commitments, right? Is that at that point, it's like, well, okay, so maybe this doesn't work. And you get instead into what, the philosopher Robert Nozick used to joke about normative sociology, which is the study of what the causes of things ought to be. And I think that we're now getting into normative policymaking, which is the study of what the solutions of things ought to be, rather than what the solutions are. Is there a way around this? How do we get evidence-based policymaking into the biggest questions and the hardest questions? And I think that is something that you see in the Trump administration, but I think it's also something you saw in the Obama administration. And how do we move beyond that and get these things up to the places where they matter most? Since I've just trashed early childhood education, and I'm probably going to be facing a pitchfork-laden mob on my way out the door, I will ask Mr. Whitehurst to start.
Well, I mean, I think one of the solutions is to think small. The more there is a strong political and cultural commitment to what is the right thing to do, the more difficult it is to bring evidence to bear. And that's why I think across administrations, as presidents campaign on what they're going to do. And if they win, candidates campaign on what they're going to do. If they win, there's a checklist of making sure that there's delivery. It's extremely hard to change that in the first couple of years of an administration when they are doing the policies that they said they were going to do. But the going small, the going local with the current model of pay for success gives a chance for evidence to work where it makes a difference and where there's less attached to it politically, where the stakes are lower for those who can make decisions. And I think that's the sweet spot in terms of moving forward. And eventually, you hope that'll bubble up to the point that there's some embarrassment for people who say, at a high level, we're going to do this, and it's clear that the evidence on that doesn't work. To plug myself for a moment, I published a piece last week on whether state pre-K is actually affecting achievement in elementary school. And so, if you're interested in this sidebar, I invite you to go have a look.
I saw some nods, and
I do think going small helps and going frequent helps. I sometimes joke and say what we have now is a fund what once worked system. it's a fund what someone thought once worked system. And you'll see 30-year latency. We just talked about Abecedarian. When was that, 45 years ago? I don't know how long ago the Abecedarian data was, Perry preschool. But the other trick is, I think, not only to be highly decentralized, because what works in one place doesn't necessarily work in the other, but it's because it melts like ice cream, everything's changing all the time. What you need to do is to increase the cadence of when things are undone.
So let me ask you about that, though. Is that, do you run into a legislative bandwidth problem, right?
The big reframing that I'd suggest is that every once in a while something will come along like the larks that say, here is a solution that ought to be rolled out. But by and large, I think it's kind of a fool's errand to attempt to legislate solutions up top. In a world where the solutions need a tremendous amount of customization locally and they need to change frequently. So instead, I see government's job is rather than to say, be prescriptive and say, here is the recipe that ought to be followed. Instead, the great opportunity for us is to say, here is a way of rewarding you if you come up with something that works in your community.
But how do we change the structure of government finance to push that down? It seems really tough. But
you know, with all the progress we've made in producing evidence, the barrier is getting evidence used. The most common use of evidence in government is a tactical use of evidence, where a decision's already been made, and you pick, you know, cherry pick the evidence that
using it the way drunks use lampposts,
exactly,
they say, for support rather than.
But there are ways to improve the use of research evidence. It's about developing relationships between producers and consumers of evidence so that the questions investigated are ones where the decision maker has a stake in what the answer is. We funded a researcher at Penn State named Max Crowley. He's developing a randomized trial of an intervention that brings researchers and congressional staff together. The researchers are randomized to whether they work with the staff or not, and the congressional staff are randomized to whether they get the intensive relationship or a lighter touch. And this is going to test an approach of relationship building where the researchers pursue questions that will find their way into legislation, depending on what their research is, and to see if that will be impactful. But it is the going small approach. It's not the big ideologically charged issues like immigration or trade. It's the everyday, but there are hundreds of everyday decisions that our government leaders need to make, and these can be informed by evidence.
So it sounds like we've got a little bit of attention, I think, because you want to push things down to the lowest possible level because these effects are often going to be local. This is a point that Jim Manzi, who writes about and wrote a book called Uncontrolled, which I recommend everyone.
He used to sit next to me, by the way, at we worked together for years.
Did he? He is a very, very clever fellow. I've had a number of really fascinating conversations with him. But he argues that, you know, when you do an RCT, he does them now for, you know, in commercial settings. He says, you know, you do an RCT on whether people like strawberry or raspberry jam. You're not proving like strawberry jam or raspberry jam is better. You're proving that like on this Saturday when I did a 4-hour test, this was the one that people liked, and that you have to do them over and over and over again. And so it may always just be informed by local conditions, right? You know, in the South they like Duke's flour, in the North they like gold medal. So I just confused mayonnaise and flour.
You did.
Duke's
mayonnaise. Being from the South,
white lily flour in the South. So you want to push that down as far as possible, but when you want expert evidence, right, there's going to be a benefit to centralization of that. So how do you resolve that tension?
So maybe I can give an example. We have to be careful to say expert evidence too often is the expertise says, if you do this, then will happen, as opposed to here's what happened.
Right.
And so the thing that stopped, we're practitioners, and so we're just, why aren't we making progress? And the reason we weren't making progress was because the rules of spending streams did not permit us to do contingent contracting. When those rules have been relaxed, and now billions of dollars have recently been PFS-enabled legislatively, we found that actually there's tons of data ready to be incorporated into contracts. And in doing that, you awaken a desire on the demand side. You awaken a desire among practitioners to use that evidence because they will be rewarded for it. Whereas before their payments were contingent on those outcomes, their incentive was to comply to the recipe. And so this is a lot easier than it seems. It has to do with relaxing constraints, right, more than it has to do with telling folks what to do better.
I think your question is a very insightful one. There is a real tension that's playing out in policy, in the research field, between education where I work, between, you know, having every school district have a first-class research shop that does the local stuff and answers the really important questions versus you know, having a federal entity that's supposed to be producing generalizable knowledge. And actually, you need both. So for the pre-K issue you talked about, people need to know in general across the nation what's working and what's not, to what effect. And then somebody who's delivering a local pre-K intervention needs to be looking very carefully at their own evidence to perfect and improve their program. And so those things seem to be in tension. They are in tension in terms of resources, but they should not be in tension in terms of the way the world works.
And we need to harness more local firepower, not just in the government agencies like school district, but our universities need to support local decision-making, need to reward their faculty for addressing local problems, for examining issues of social impact, working in partnership with decision makers in nonprofits and agencies.
So I really want to talk about this melts like ice cream metaphor, because I think that's so interesting. I've never heard that before, and it's really good. And it's something that I've written about. I think it's something everyone here has thought about pretty hard. So I see sort of three possibilities for why this happens, and this is not to say that they may all three be in play, but you know, one is that it's kind of like antibiotic resistance, right? Is you do something and people figure out how to game it. So you set up a program, some sort of cash transfer program, and it works in the beginning, and then people figure out how to get around it. And this is something you saw with Obamacare, or it seems that we did, where people figured out that they could go without health insurance they could buy health insurance for the first 5 months of the year, get all of their knee surgery and everything else, and then drop the insurance for the rest. And then that, of course, spikes the premiums for the people who are really sick. The second possibility is just that you've got scale problems, right? There was a wonderful sort of example of this from the Los Angeles Unified School District with their school lunch program, where they did this elaborate testing of this beautiful new fresh food program. It was wonderful. And then they roll it out. And like, it turns out that there's a real difference between having a crack team of highly dedicated people who are making this beautiful food to put out for people to sample, and then what actually happens in the cafeteria lunchroom. And then in the cafeteria lunchroom, like, there's these salads and the food lettuce is kind of wilted and people complain and they're like, well, it's not unhealthy for you. It just looks brown and disgusting. So eat it. And the kids didn't eat it, and they bought a bunch of Cheetos, and then, you know, you actually had the opposite of the result you were intending. And the third one is just the statistical anomalies, right, is that you take a program that's got 65 kids in it. If you run 20 of those programs and, you know, and look for statistical significance at the 95% confidence, you're going to get one just on average. One of those programs is just going to be a random outlier result. And if you have publication bias, and if you're going to basically like publish that one, the other 19 studies that didn't find anything don't get published, and you think, wow, this works great, and let's go do it, and then you try to scale it up, and it doesn't work.
So there's a fourth, which may overlap what your framework, but which you mentioned, Jim Manzi. This is the language that Jim Manzi uses, and it's becoming much more prevalent. I happen to be married to the dean of computer science at Northeastern, who's a machine learning expert, so I've learned a fair amount from her. But it's called causal density.
Yes.
So if you're in a world where there are many things that can cause a change in behavior, that runs head-on with the way we do science, because science is a hold all else equal type of a concept. And the problem, this melts like ice cream thing. We had perfect science. We had no confirmation, no bias. You know, we had N equals 100,000 every time, and we had absolutely pristine RCT science. We had perfect replication, because it really had to do with, you know, maybe the color of the ink on the letter we sent was slightly different, but we had absolutely full fidelity to the model. And we had perfectly algorithmic approaches of who the letters were sent to. It was all based on computers and data that was highly stable. And yet it stopped working. So the reason it stopped working was because conditions in the marketplace changed. And there were many conditions that were causal to people's behavior that we could not control. that changed. And I would argue that that's why most RCTs, all the reasons you said are correct. There's a lot of reasons why things you learn that worked are not generalizable. But the fundamental reason is because the world changes so frequently. So unless you up the cadence and just, in essence, you're just funding what's working now and then changing it and doing the next and doing the next and kind of following things around, you're kind of doomed. And so writing a law that for 30 years says everyone do the same thing and do this, are we surprised when we look at the effectiveness of those programs? They're not very effective.
And I understand that you, sir, have to go catch a plane.
I do. Are you trying to get rid of me?
No. I was given a note that said you need to catch a plane.
Very
so
when.
So whenever you have to leave, we will bid you a
fine
adieu.
Thank you.
I mean, we should also add there's a fifth one, although I'm not sure it replicated. Was this idea that you, when you study people, they change. So they did a study in a factory.
Awful
they raised
effect,
the lights
yeah.
to see how productive people got. Productivity went up. They lowered the level of lighting. It also went up. And it turns out that when people know they're being watched, they act differently than they do when they're. So other thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, it's also the case that social science research, unlike work in physics, is about variance and averages. And so when you do a randomized trial and group A does significantly better than group B, if you look at the distribution of outcomes, they overlap quite substantially. And sometimes they overlap for reasons that are systematic. Certain types of people react well in condition A and they don't in condition B. That's just the nature of it. But it does make the replication and extension very difficult because a local experience is always the local experience. It's not the on average experience. It's how did the lunch, you know, how did the wonderful lunch program work in this cafeteria? That's a great challenge to social science thinking because the people you want to be consuming the work are experiencing the message and they don't agree with it. You know, it's working for my kid or the salad is delicious here. And we need them to think about what that means, to think about how to hedge bets, to allow individual variation in implementation and program characteristics to better match local needs and local realities. We're a long way from being there. And I will point out that the A-B comparisons done in business are trivially easy. The Capital One stuff is trivially easy. You can do it online. You can change the color of your lettering. You can get feedback pretty immediately. If you've set up the right infrastructure, it doesn't cost much. To try to do most of that stuff with real complex social programs is orders
RCTs
of magnitude more difficult.
RCTs are so hard. I mean, we've done, we used to do thousands of them at Capital One, piece of cake. And we've done dozens of RCTs at Third Sector. The hardest part of all is the ethics of recruiting the subjects, because you are denying care from people if you try to randomize. But it's as if you're trying to have a scientific laboratory and there are herds of buffaloes running through your laboratory constantly. So that's very, very real. I have not seen a single RCT that did not have implementation problems in the science that made it difficult to interpret the results.
Yeah, but despite all these problems, and I recognize all four or five that have been articulated, we've made tremendous progress.
Yeah,
I am not in any way denigrating that. I'm really outlining the challenges.
You know,
it's a great point.
One of the senators this morning said Thomas Edison tried 100 light bulbs before he got the one that works. This is complicated business. And it shouldn't surprise us that 80% of randomized trials fail. Same happens in medicine. Same happens in other fields. We need to do this work more cheaply. Administrative data helps a lot with that. We need to do it more locally. We need to build more local capacity so they can make their own decisions when implementing programs that have worked elsewhere. But we've made great progress in getting credible evidence produced. We need more take-up of evidence, given that it's available.
I am getting nervous about your flight now. We should actually go to the audience, and we should let Mr. Overholtzer go.
Okay. Thank you. And as my parting point, that's Thank you for saying that. That's what's happening. What is happening is that the information revolution is dropping by orders of magnitude the cost of getting very good interpretable data. I was just complaining about RCTs, but the truth is that there are now, you can in many, many cases, you get census data. You don't need to worry about drawing samples. You can actually get census data, and you can, and there are natural experiments all over the place. You can randomize in many cases at a much, much lower cost than before. And that is what's really happening here. What's really happening here is that the abundance of information at low cost is kind of newly present. And it's just the rest of our systems were not designed to embrace data. And so the reforms have to do with relaxing the constraints that keep us from embracing data and then incorporating that data in as a feedback loop. So I would have to agree tremendously. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sorry to be. Thank you, sir. And I think we have time for just a couple of questions from the audience. So in the back, you ma'am, yeah, you just turned it. Yeah.
That was great.
And please state your name.
Talked about this. My name is Barbara Dello, and I'm a nurse. And you did talk about this a little bit, so it's kind of a follow-up question, but how do you ensure the integrity of the experts in politically homogeneous areas? I was in a nursing association in New York State, and even obvious questions and truths would not be heard. Should there be multiple views within the research community or the community of experts?
Thank you. Gentlemen?
Yeah, well, there's a scientific process. There's peer review, blind peer review for adjudicating the credibility of research findings, whether it's through an application for a grant or for a publication. I think that this is one important reason why it's important for scientists to submit their research to journals and not just issue reports that are not reviewed. When it comes to their judgment within decision makers, whether it's politics or other contexts, that's more difficult because the politicians may choose, may engage in the tactical use of research instead of the instrumental, as I described, so it's more difficult.
I think what's very important is I'm not peer review doesn't get us very far. The very strongest journals have inter-rater reliability of like 0.3, and there is some famous research done on published articles submitted again, which is to change the title and the author of a paper submitted 10 years ago. You put it back through the process, and they're turned down. So peer review is weak. I think what's very important in terms of high-stakes decision-making is that there be entities that have rules for deciding the quality of evidence. And so it's not the consensus of three reviewers. It was some consensus about what the rules ought to be, mm-hmm. and then you believe the research or not, or you question its quality based on those rules. And so we have that in some federal entities, not in others. We have those in nursing. The What Works Clearinghouse in the U.S. Department of Education was modeled on the Ontario Nursing Association's evidence guides. And so I think that's a critical thing that federal government can and should do and is in the business of doing. It does it for the FDA, for example, vetting the evidence and judging its quality and its relevance to the issues at hand.
All right, I think we have time for one more, and I should take from this side of the room if anyone has a question, because I feel like I'm... Okay, you, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Gabrielle Lewis. I'm from the St. Albans School of Public Service. So I think it's universally, we touched on this earlier, that corporations in the private sector does a good job of using evidence. How can the public sector work with the private sector through programs or whatnot to learn how to use evidence better and in a more effective way? Thank you.
Gentlemen?
Well, again, the private sector, where randomized trials and A-B trials are dominant, it is in industries where there's a very clear and agreed upon bottom line. In Jim Banzi's book, There's an anecdote that always sticks with me. It's a guy he's interviewing who's at a casino in Las Vegas. And the casino employee is saying, there's three ways I can lose my job here. I can engage in sexual harassment. I can use drugs. Or I can run an advertising campaign for this casino in Southern California that's not delivered as a randomized trial. And so the consequences go so directly to the bottom line that everybody is motivated to do the work and to figure out what works and to increase at the margin earnings. It's much more difficult in the public in the public sector. So one of the challenges there is that if you want to know whether pre-K works, for what? You know, does it provide useful daycare for parents? Does it help kids during the year they're in preschool? Does it make them a nicer people when they're adults? You know, there are 15 or 20 outcomes you can think about. And so the idea of doing the – so it's hard to agree on the outcome. Then it's much more difficult to do the intervention itself because it involves politics, it involves convincing people. So I think there are things to be learned, but there are also some fundamental dissimilarities between business RCTs and social services RCTs that are just part of the reality that has to be dealt with.
Yeah, I agree with everything you've just said, Russ. I would add that some of what we can learn are about the value of administrative data, the appropriateness of using data that's already being collected so we can learn, which is something we don't do very well on the public side, and about the importance of doing lots and lots of trials and lots of contexts so that we learn not just what works on average, but what works for whom and under what circumstances.
I think there's a great David Cutler, the Harvard healthcare economist, once said to me that, the things where the outcomes are most dependent on the people who you put into the system or healthcare and education, and that's where the outcomes are hardest to measure, and it's probably not a coincidence that that's where costs are growing in the most out-of-control fashion, because we can't measure the outputs, so we just keep cramming the inputs into the funnel and hope something comes out. I want to thank our two great remaining panelists and also our absent panelists for a terrific and provocative discussion. And I want to thank the audience for being good questioners and for listening with such alacrity to what our panelists were saying.